You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2009, the 16th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in Montreal, Canada, from February 8th through February 11th, 2009.
Hello and welcome. This is Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of thebodypro.com. CROI is always such an exciting conference with a wide-ranging mix of research from basic HIV science to the latest antiretrovirals. Today we're going to focus on an issue that HIV researchers have been struggling to understand for a while now, and it's the association between cardiovascular disease and HIV. I have with me today clinician researcher Dr. David Wall from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's been following the research, and he'll share with us some of what he's learned at CROI. Welcome, Dr. Wall. I know it takes some time to digest all the great science presented at CROI. What now stands out for you?
I think for me at CROI, what I'll remember most about this conference was maybe the beginning of a shift in my own mind away from sort of the same issues we've been batting around CROI after CROI, conference after conference. And by that I mean I think more now about a bigger picture idea, not drug one versus drug two, or, you know, what's the best way to lower someone's LDL cholesterol who has HIV infection, but the bigger picture of how big a problem is cardiovascular disease for our patients. You know, where are the data that indicate that the risk is higher? And if it is higher and there is excess cardiovascular disease among people living with this infection, how big is that excess? And what are the trends over time? And most importantly, what's causing it? What's at the root of this? Is it all therapy, or is it all virus, or is it both? You know, what's going on here? And I think we're really starting to get a sense that, A, there's a big problem, because most of the data do indicate that people with HIV suffer from diseases of aging more so than they should. And there were some really compelling tidbits or sort of deltoid presentations here that help us understand that. And also, you know, sort of, well, if that's the case, what can we do about it? And that's where we get into the etiologies.
Uh-huh. So most of the data presented was descriptive.
Well, there's a mix. And for anyone who's not been to this conference, it's pretty unique in that it's pretty small. The science is generally very good. But, you know, these are conferences, and so presentations are made looking back at established data, and people present their preliminary findings, and people also present pilot data. So you get really a mixture of information, some of which is much more thoroughly backed up by numbers and by analyses, and others which are really just nascent, and we just have to, you know, connect the dots over time. So, you know, you have to be careful here. A poster presentation may have, you know, a study of 10,000 people, and next to it is a study of 30 people. But the one with 30 people is really, really, really important, and the one with 10,000 people, well, you know, they didn't really have the data to look at. They didn't collect it. So, you know, you have to be careful when you're looking through this. There's a lot of data, and you get inundated. The trick is, and I think the value of doing something like this, is trying to pick out the pearls that you find along the beach.
So what were the pearls?
Well, and that's the other beauty about going to a conference. My pearls may be different than someone else's pearls, and it's very individual. It depends what you stand in front of and take note of and what you care about. I think, you know, vis-a-vis cardiovascular disease, some of the things that I really cared about were some of the bigger studies that quantified just how much cardiovascular disease we're seeing. Because we talk about things, but it's nice to have, you know, numbers. We can say, well, there's an increased risk of cardiovascular disease among HIV-infected people. Well, okay, well, now what are the references for that? Well, you know, DAD, that's going to be a study we're going to talk about time and time again, because it's such an important opportunity to look at what happens to people living with HIV infection. This is a huge meta-cohort of people, as everyone knows, mostly European, but some North American sites, large in that we're talking about over 30,000 people. And you know, they've generated a lot of data. One of the things that I really liked was that they presented, you know, data on why people die. What are the causes of death in this prospective study? They have over 2,000 deaths that have occurred while they've been following people. And the death rate is pretty remarkable. It's 13.8 per 1,000 person years, and they were able to categorize why people died. And still, you know, this is in some ways a retroscope, because it's looking at people who died over the last several years. This is not like what people are dying of in 2009 necessarily. So you have to take this with a little bit of grain of salt, but it says, well, this is what people are dying from over the last several years in people with HIV infection. And, you know, age-related causes was a third. And that's not a surprise to any of us in clinics, especially here in the United States, where we continue to see people who are really challenged try to deal with their HIV infection. But that means that two-thirds were not necessarily AIDS-related or classically AIDS-related, in that they didn't die of PCP or cryptococcal meningitis or the AIDS-defining conditions. They died of other things. And of the entire group, you know, 1 out of 10 died from a cardiovascular disease related event. That, to me, seems pretty remarkable. There are other things, of course, like liver-related diseases and cancers that are not classically associated with AIDS that also contributed quite a bit. But that, you know, cardiovascular disease is responsible for 1 out of every 10 deaths in this cohort is, I think, striking, especially since it's a European cohort, and maybe here it would be a little bit worse. There was another study, again, from Europe that overlaps a little bit with DAD, the EuroCEDA studies. This is, a large meta-cohort of people following people over time. And again, they were able to break down causes of death by age-related versus non-age-related. If you just look at the non-age-related death, you know, this is over 680 people that they've looked at in this cohort who didn't die from AIDS. Almost equal amount did die from AIDS. But of the people who didn't die from AIDS, you know, again, about a third now died from a cardiovascular disease. Malignancy made up most of the rest. So I think that was really very helpful for me and striking for me, and kind of quantifies it. In a very similar, and this is the last one of these big sort of database studies, the Kaiser Permanente group in California, every conference or so look at their MI rates. They're able to do this best by looking at hospitalization rates for MI. So you have to be a little careful. So we're not looking necessarily at every event, but we're looking at who gets admitted to a hospital in this large, you know, prepaid care organization in California. And what they were able to show is that for the last several years, clearly there's been excess hospitalization for MI among people in the group who are HIV infected compared to people who are not HIV infected, but it's been going down over the last couple of years. In fact, you know, it became no different, the hospitalization rates for MI among HIV-positive people than HIV-negative people who are in the HMO. So that may be a little bit of a bright spot. Again, caveats galore. This is hospitalization rates. This is not exactly events, and they weren't able to correct for a lot of the things we care about, such as smoking. But again, I think it helps us understand a little bit about maybe where we're at. And generally, in this cohort as well, if you look at the last few years, people with HIV seem to have more MIs, at least the MIs that get you into a hospital.
Isn't the Kaiser Permanente group a particular population? These are all insured patients?
It's an HMO-like group, although, and I think they would probably argue that they have a pretty diverse group of people, maybe not as diverse socioeconomically as the epidemic in the U.S., but certainly racially and ethnically diverse, given they're in California. But you're right. There are certain things we have to be careful about. And this is just one view, you know, of the bigger picture. But again, helpful, especially if the trends that they're seeing with decreases in MIs, at least serious MIs over time, if they're seen in other cohorts, that would be maybe an indicator that we're doing a better job of preventing this or missing it, I guess you could also say, but I think that's unlikely.
Uh-huh. So mostly this sounds like descriptive and not an investigation into why this is happening.
Right. So moving into sort of the idea of, you know, well, here's, you know, the magnitude. Is there more cardiovascular disease among HIV-infected people relative to HIV-negative people? Then we start getting into, you know, what's going on. And there were other studies that I didn't mention, the smaller studies. Priscilla Sue did a very nice analysis looking at cardiac calcium, coronary calcium scores, showing that people with HIV had higher scores than people without HIV, beyond what you would expect. And these were people even without HIV therapy, so that HIV itself seems to be doing something. And I think that's where we're getting into some really interesting things about, well, what is the virus doing itself? Importantly, at CROI, there's more and more emphasis on what's the problem with the virus, what's the problem with viremia, whether we're looking at inflammatory markers, whether we're looking at immune activation markers, coagulation markers. There were some really important data that seemed to indicate that people with HIV, just due to the virus itself, may be at higher risk for cardiovascular disease. So again, moving beyond observational studies, there were data from the FRAM cohort. Again, the beauty of FRAM, unlike DAD, they have a control group. DAD only involves people with HIV infection. FRAM has people who are HIV infected, but also people in a control group that don't have HIV. DAD is prospective, FRAM is cross-sectional, all these sorts of differences. But in really what I think is probably the final word, perhaps, on carotid intimal thickness studies, the FRAM people did a really nice analysis looking at people with HIV and those without HIV, controlling for a whole bunch of different things, and looking at the carotid intimal thickness. And lo and behold, again, people with HIV infection, using a really rigorous way of measuring intimal thickness of their carotids, had increased thickness, increased medial thickness, a precursor of atherosclerosis or a marker of atherosclerosis. So I think, again, we're seeing that there's an effect perhaps of the virus itself. One of the most striking, I think, pieces of data along this line came from Colorado. It was a very interesting study, very small, where 10 HIV-infected men aged 28 to 44 underwent a pretty rigorous evaluation of their endovascular health. If your endothelium, the cells lining your blood vessels, is not healthy, you're not healthy, and nor is your circulatory system. And what they did is they provoked the endothelial cells, they provoked the vasculature to dilate using two different chemicals. So they used acetylcholine as a challenge. Acetylcholine is an endothelium-dependent vasodilator, and also nitroprusside, which is independent of the endothelium in its vasodilatory properties. They administered these to these men and did brachial reactivity. So for the men who were HIV positive and, you know, age 28 to 44, they were able to see what were the responses. Interestingly, the acetylcholine response was a little bit less than they thought. They compared this to HIV negative men who were in the same age range, and then 10 HIV negative men who were much older, 59 to 68 years. And what they found was the patterns of reactivity with provocation with acetylcholine was dramatically different across the HIV-positive to HIV-negative men, such that the HIV-positive men, their vasculature responded like the 60-year-old HIV-negative men and was much more suppressed compared to the HIV-negative men of the same age. And it was only the acetylcholine provocation where you saw the differences, indicating this is an endothelial problem. Men with HIV have an endothelial dysfunction that is analogous to what we see in older men, suggesting that there's premature aging of the vasculature and the vasculature reactivity with HIV. And these are all treatment-naive men. These are not people on any sort of drug that you're worried about. These are treatment-naive men, relatively young.
What's the average length of infection?
They didn't really put that in, and it's, you know, a small study. I think this certainly is provocative, and we have to see more about this, but boy, this was significant results.
And this is one of those tiny studies that you say.
This is a tiny study, but, you know, for this measure, when done can be very, very reliable and reproducible. So it was all done at one center by a group that's pretty familiar with how to do this, and I think we're really able to generate some very thought-provoking information that we now have to move on and work with. But it fits along in lockstep with the data from the calcium coronary scores and other data that we're seeing that indicates that, you know, people with HIV, they've got a problem on their hands. And even DAD, way back when, showed us data looking at the Framingham risk calculator in a study that was missing data. But they showed us that the Framingham risk score in DAD underpredicted actual MI events in that cohort. If they just took people in the DAD study, did a Framingham score on them, it underpredicted MIs in the cohort, indicating that maybe there's another factor, call it the HIV factor, that has to be entered into the equation.
And it's just pure HIV. It's not length of time infected, maybe. It's not...
Length of time is hard because we never really know length of time. We could kind of guess it from length of, you know, time from diagnosis. But, you know, we don't really generally know. And I think in these smaller studies, there's going to be quite a bit of variability. But you're right, that has to play into it.
Because I would think that if someone's just infected this year, you wouldn't see any changes yet. But, you know, it would be interesting to find out.
I think you're right that there probably is, you know, a duration of infection where this starts to mount and accumulate. Perhaps early on, we don't see as much. We don't know this. But generally, most of the people we're involving in any of these studies will have had HIV for years, and you would expect that over that kind of period of time, given what we know about other risk factors for cardiovascular disease, that may be sufficient to cause the damage we're talking about.
And analysis of any correlation with smoking or genetic issues or environmental issues, you know, were there, these patients overweight? Is anything like that going on as well?
In this particular study, I think that, you know, there was no difference across the arms of anything that you'd be concerned about like that. So this is not explained by smoking or major differences in baseline cardiovascular disease risk. But you certainly, in larger studies, would need to think a lot about that. This group was pretty careful about selecting people to make sure that there was none of that confounding. And, you know, you can do that in a smaller study that's a little bit more pure. These were all people who had normal blood pressure, who had no medication, non-diabetic. Their lipids were all normal. You know, they didn't have any evidence of cardiovascular disease. You know, so I think that they were really well matched as far as that was concerned. And, you know, they weren't smokers.
So that's a pretty big discovery if it turns out to be true.
Well, I think it fits into this whole thing that we've been talking about over the last few months, which is that there does seem to be an excess of not just cardiovascular disease, but other diseases that we associate with the aging process. And it seems to be happening in people with HIV either more so or at an earlier age. So, you know, we're talking about not only cardiovascular disease, but even malignancies. When you think about malignancies, and we've talked about that before because we know immunosuppression can lead to malignancies, but even malignancies we don't necessarily associate with immunosuppression. We also know that, you know, bone mineral density is lower in people with HIV infection. We know that, you know, there may be more diabetes. We know that there may be more neurocognitive decline. So things that we think about that may occur in people as they get older seem to be happening earlier in people with HIV infection. I think cardiovascular disease is the most important one of those.
And there were some interesting studies about HDL. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, there was one in particular that caught my eye, and I've actually had to go back and re-listen to the presentation. And I think that's something worthwhile doing. The good thing about this particular conference is that you can download most of the posters and many of the presentations. And since most of the presentations are only 10 minutes, it's not that difficult. The quality is sometimes not as good as you'd like. It depends upon your computer and your connection. But I really do think it's good to do that. And I actually did that again for this presentation I think you're referring to. And these, again, are data that came out of the SMART study. The SMART study was that randomized study that randomized people to continue on their HIV medicines if they were on HIV medicines, or stop their HIV medicines if they were on HIV medicines, or defer starting them if they were ready to start medicines, and then until, you know, your T-cell count got to 250 and then start back again. The idea being, can we reduce your exposure to HIV medicines and thus your risk for bad things happening to you, like cardiovascular disease or hepatic disease or renal disease or whatever? At the time the study was designed, the assumption was that HIV therapies are metabolically toxic and we should limit your exposure. And why don't we do that in a way that keeps your CD4 cell count kind of in the right range, almost like sliding scale HIV therapy, for those of you familiar with sliding scale insulin. And that study, of course, famously was halted early, 16 months into the study, because there were excess cardiovascular disease, renal disease, and hepatic disease, but it was in the people who discontinued their HIV therapy, not the people who continued on HIV therapy. But subsets of the study and subgroup analyses have been coming out over the last few years and producing really very, very important data for our understanding of this issue we're talking about now, HIV and its direct effects on metabolic complications. And one of the presentations from the SMART data set that were presented at CROI looked at HDL, as you mentioned. And we know that there were predictors of bad things happening in this study. One was getting off of your HIV medicines. But they've also looked at other factors that may be across both arms. And the presentation was looking specifically at HDL and LDL particle size, because we know that there's different types of lipoproteins, but they also come in different sizes. And generally, the smaller the particle, the more atherogenic it is. And this holds not only for LDL, but also for HDL, that if a person has HDLs that are smaller, that's not as good as people who have larger HDLs. In a really nice demonstration of this, the presenter showed the lipid profiles of two individuals, which were very, very similar when you just look at total LDL, total HDL, triglycerides, etc. But then when you looked at the subfractions of their HDL and LDL, there were major differences between these two individuals who clinically we would say was no different, but that their risk profile could be different looking at the particle size. So what they did do was a case control study of cardiovascular disease cases and controls who did not have cardiovascular disease, and looked at the particle size to see if they were different. And the HDL particle concentration was significantly different between those who had cardiovascular disease and those who did not have cardiovascular disease. And in addition, when you look at people who are in the treatment discontinuation arm, the arm that did not do so well when it comes to these events, there was a significant drop in HDL particle concentration as well. So not only at baseline, if you had a lower HDL particle concentration, were you more likely to have cardiovascular disease, but if you got into the discontinuation arm, your particle size was more likely to drop than if you had been in the other arm. And they did a really nice presentation in this talk about how when you add this on to the other risk factors that they've identified, like IL-6. IL-6 is a cytokine that we make in response to a whole bunch of different things, but also to HIV, and it's been associated with cardiovascular disease outside of HIV. And in the SMART study, high IL-6, high CRP, high D-dimer, they were all associated with bad things happening to you in this study. Well, if you overlay IL-6 levels being high or low with total HDL particle concentration being high or low, they were at least additive, such that when you had, high IL-6 and you had low HDL particle concentration, your odds for getting cardiovascular disease went up substantially. So they seem to build on each other, and that's very helpful for us to understand this. So, there's a whole industry that is trying to sell us particle size determination tests, and some cardiologists have more favorable opinion than others. The question, of course, for all the SMART data, and I think this is a really important question, is how do we integrate this into our clinical care? They've already showed us, as I said, IL-6 is important. They showed us D-dimers are important. D-dimers are really easy to measure. We get it in our hospitals and clinics all the time. CRP, doctors get CRP all the time. So should we be doing CRP? Should we be doing D-dimer? IL-6 may be a little bit out there because it's more researchy and it's not as easy to get. And doing the particle size. And we may be able to come up with a much more insightful profile, lipid profile for our patients. But that's hard to say. We haven't even gotten there outside of HIV yet, let alone within HIV. But this is where I think we need to move on to and think about, can we better assess our patients' risks beyond the lipid profiles we have right now if our current risk assessments may be falling a little short?
Uh-huh. So is there an understanding yet about whether treatment choice can accelerate or slow down this premature aging process?
Well, it's a really good question. I think that, on the one hand, you could talk about HIV treatments, and I'll talk about that very briefly because I don't want to get too bogged down into that, although that's the thing that people like to talk about. But you're right. Are there other treatments that we may have to think about? Are we using statins to the degree that we should? Are our patients getting aspirin? Who really should get aspirin? Those at moderate to high risk of cardiovascular disease for whom there's not a contraindication. There are modalities out there that we may not be employing as robustly as we should. And so I think those things that we think about for anti-aging, if you will, for other populations outside of HIV, we might have to think about for this one as well. When you get to specific HIV drugs, though, you know, just as a preface, I think we should be careful not to let us get too distracted about this. I think that over the last few months, we've allowed, understandably, discussion of abacavir to really dominate the metabolic complications arena, and I think we should be careful about that. I think it's an important issue, but remember, this is not a drug that was extremely popular. Most of the people who need abacavir are on it for a good reason. Many don't have many other choices. And the majority of people who probably get abacavir don't have extremely high risk of cardiovascular disease. So I think it's important, but I just don't think we should drown out almost everything else to allow this conversation to dominate. And at this conference, again, data on abacavir were presented. It's become sort of a cottage industry. DAD folks who first allowed us to understand that there may be a problem with abacavir updated their data. Interestingly, they're now showing us that not only recent exposure to abacavir is associated with risk of an MI, but it's looking now like cumulative exposure. Interestingly, they were able to add on more data about tenofovir, which is what we've been waiting for, and there doesn't seem to be any risk with tenofovir. And I think that's important because one of the big criticisms of the DAD analysis with abacavir is that there could be channeling bias such that those with higher risk for cardiovascular disease could have been channeled to abacavir. That should be the case as well for tenofovir, and that wasn't seen here. So I think that was helpful. The other part of it is that they also started looking at protease inhibitors, and they found that lopinavir, ritonavir, and indinavir look like they are now associated with MI, cumulative exposure to any of these drugs. Importantly, the way the analyses were done, if you were ever on the drug, doesn't matter how long, apparently, and how long you have not been on the drug, once you are on the drug, even if it was discontinued, the subsequent follow-up continues to be attributable to the level of the exposure at discontinuation. So if you were on lopinavir or ritonavir 3 years ago for 6 months, you're in the lopinavir or ritonavir group. Whatever happened, we're thinking about someone who's been exposed to lopinavir or ritonavir. So there's a lot of discussion that I think will happen further with this. There was a French hospital study that also, it's a large database, they did a case control study looking at the abacavir question. Again, complicated statistics. They found something similar and not similar to the DAD study. They found that there may be an association with abacavir when they look at the cases of MI versus not MI, but that it wasn't what DAD found. They found that recent exposure, but only within the first year, that's where you see the risk of MI, and it goes away over time. That's not what DAD is finding. So, you know, these things don't exactly measure up. This is very complicated statistics, and it's just a matter of, you know, what you believe almost. There may be a signal here. The ACTG did a large analysis looking at people in their clinical trials. Importantly, this is nice because these are not people who selected to be on abacavir because, you know, of any risk factor. It was randomized. So if you're on abacavir in these trials, it's because you were assigned abacavir. They didn't find any risk associated with abacavir, albeit there were something like only 27 MIs and 60 cardiovascular disease events in this cohort. But, you know, that's 10,000 people. So I feel like if there is a risk, it's probably relatively fairly small, and that could be argued, you know, probably occurs more likely in people with more risk factors. So I'm not as blown away by this. I think we should not get too caught up in the politics and the arguments. I think the data are there, and clinicians will have to make decisions for themselves. But I think most clinicians are feeling there's some concern, but I don't think we should take it and blow it out of proportion.
So this conference was so different than previous conferences, at least in the last 2 years, where there was so much new data about new drugs and a lot of excitement about new things. And this conference seemed to be more about new problems or deeper understanding of these problems, and not at all about new antiretroviral drugs and all the wonders of them, but sort of almost more depressing, I think, than upbeat in terms of a conference. So do you agree?
I don't know. I actually thought it was a great conference, and it may just be because I like Montreal. But, you know, I thought that there was a lot going on. I think the science was really good. We're trying to hammer out, you know, what's going on with our patients in a bigger way. And I think we're taking a bigger picture approach. And so I found that very helpful. Again, I did find this common thread throughout many of the presentations of, you know, lo and behold, our patients are going to be surviving for decades, and how are we going to prepare them for that and prevent devastating consequences from occurring, whether it be neurocognitive or cardiovascular disease or bone-related or what have you. I think that there were less new and exciting drugs because we've gone through a flush of the pipeline just recently where we had some great drugs come out. You know, and I wouldn't undersell, you know, sort of the presentations about the ritonavir-like boosters that can pharmacologically boost other drugs. You know, there are two products that were discussed at the conference, both of which are exciting. And relative to what we're talking about, if they turn out to be cardiovascularly neutral, as they seem to be, at least the Gilead product does, that's going to be a tremendous advance, potentially. I think that, you know, again, the conferences all come in their different flavors, and sometimes that's by accident, sometimes by design. But, you know, I thought here we're starting to get onto something here, whether it be inflammation or paying more attention to these long-term living with HIV issues. Those are exciting to me, and so I kind of like that.
But Dr. Wall, wouldn't you agree that from a patient point of view, much of the new data from CROI about cardiovascular disease seems worrisome, since there's nothing really been suggested to prevent these issues?
Agreed. But you know what? And this is a point I make constantly to people who ask about that. The first step of developing an intervention is to first, A, recognize the problem, and B, understand the problem. We're getting to the recognition. I think we're all appreciating there's more stuff going on. You only have to pick up the New York Times to see articles about aging and HIV. Two, we're getting a better handle. What's going on? There do seem to be markers of this badness that we're able to identify. You know, I think it's not going to take too long, given the community of researchers and advocates who are involved with HIV, for us to start seeing interventional studies coming along. You know, that's something we do very well, and we're very quick, you know, right off the blocks. So, but the first thing is we don't want to go down the wrong path. This study helped me think about what's the preparation, what do we need to understand as we go forward, so we don't go off on some tangent that doesn't matter. There was a convergence. You know, inflammation is bad in a whole bunch of different ways. You know that from outside of HIV. In HIV, it's even worse. Let's see what we could do about reducing inflammation, and then let's see if it has a benefit. That's where I see this going, and I think you're going to see more of that over time.
Uh-huh. Were the studies on cognitive issues related to this issue? There were nerve damage studies and cognitive problems.
There are, and there was even one that indicated that people with metabolic syndrome had higher risk of neurocognitive impairment with HIV. You know, that's important. And when asked, well, why is that? Well, the answer is going to continue to be, you know, inflammation. It's like in the movie The Graduate, you know, plastics, that's the future. For here, it's inflammation, and I think that we are seeing more and more about this, and coagulation by extension. We're going to start seeing more about the bad humors that come about when you have HIV that is not controlled, or not adequately controlled. And I think that trumps all these discussions about this nucleoside versus that nucleoside, or this protease inhibitor versus that protease inhibitor.
Well, we've come to the end of our time together. What a terrific discussion you have provided, Dr. Wall. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you for the opportunity.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thank you for listening to this report from CROI 2009. For more coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2009.